Morning, everybody. Go to a movie. What's a kid's show? Especially almost anything from Disney. Listen to a musical. Or talk to almost anyone, and you'll probably hear some phrases like this. You be you. Be true to yourself. You can be anything. Follow your heart. Find yourself. Behind these phrases is the idea that the purpose of life and the path to happiness and fulfillment is to find your own individual self and desires and then express those to the world, regardless of what family, friends, authorities, or God might say. In musicals and movies, the usual plot narrative involves someone who finds and forgets or forges their own self-identity in opposition to all the naysayers. This philosophy about the path to happiness and to a flourishing life is actually ground zero in the battle of ideas between the believing church and a secular society. This is where we start going in different directions. Sociologists call this philosophy expressive individualism. That's a phrase you might want to try to remember. Expressive individualism. This is the philosophy of our time. It's the overarching rule of our time. Australian church leader Mark Sayers has listed the primary beliefs of expressive individualism thusly. Expressive individualism. Number one. The highest good is individual freedom, happiness, self-definition, and self-expression. Number two, traditions, religions, received wisdom, regulations, and social ties that restrict individual freedom, happiness, self-definition, and self-expression must be reshaped, deconstructed, or destroyed. Number three, the world will inevitably improve as the scope of individual freedom grows. Technology, in particular the internet, will motor this progression towards utopia. Number four, the primary social ethic is tolerance of everyone's self-defined quest for individual freedom and self-expression. Any deviation from this ethic of tolerance is dangerous and must not be tolerated. Therefore, social justice is less about economic or class inequality and more about issues of equality relating to individual identity, self-expression, and personal autonomy. Number five, humans are inherently good. Number six, large-scale structures and institutions are suspicious at best and evil at worst. Number seven, all forms of external authority are rejected, and personal authenticity is lauded. It's everything. As a result, for most people, individual short-term happiness has become the measure of what is good. In his book, Same-Sex Attraction in the Church, Ed Shaw writes, "The great authority in the world we live is our personal happiness. If someone or something leads to unhappiness in our life, then they or it must be wrong. If someone or something makes us happy, then they or it must be right." Now, nearly every one of us in this room has pretty much heard this philosophy our entire lives. From every direction. From parents, from friends, from families, from teachers, from coworkers and neighbors, as well as movies and plays and popular music and advertising and just any possible input you could imagine, we've gotten it. It's utterly pervasive, and it's not making us happy. It's not making us happy. After over 50 years of promoting this philosophy, my entire adult life, our society is riddled with greed and selfishness like we wouldn't have imagined when I was a kid 50 years ago. Our politics is full of it. Our schools are full of it. Our businesses and corporations are full of it. We are more divided, more violent, more lonely, and more unhappy. Integrity is a rare commodity. And who gets hurt the most from all this selfish pursuit? The weak, the poor, the children, the refugees, and all the people that happen to stand in the way of our personal happiness. It's completely infected our viewpoints as well regarding love and sexuality. And it's affected many people's view of God. Instead of the God of the Bible, they have a new God. Now, the only God they will accept is the God who makes me happy. All kinds of sexual expression is justified on the basis of self-expression and what makes me happy. On the basis of what makes me happy is therefore good, nearly every person who committed adultery or hurt someone else in their sexual expression has justified their behavior. My lover makes me happy. Can't you be happy for my happiness? Never mind, I left a wife and kids at home. Similarly, it's used to justify engaging in what you might call hookup culture, engaging in promiscuous sex with no relational commitment whatever, often not even making eye contact. The argument is, if I'm sexually attracted to someone, then I should be free to express that desire. If it makes me happy, then it must be good. Never mind that the happiness doesn't last very long for all the parties involved, and that where the line gets in terms of where your self-expression becomes harmful is hard to nail down. Often hand in hand with this value on self-fulfillment and an expression is the idea that lots of sex is what will make us happy. That's the path to lots of happiness, and sexual expression should never be constrained or channeled. And if anyone should be denied or somehow excluded from having lots of sex, that's a tragic, evil thing. No one should ever be asked to be celibate, and no one should ever ask to remain faithful to a marriage that doesn't include lots of sex. No one should ever be able asked to deny their self-preferences or their ambitions or their deep desires, unless, of course, they're a pedophile or a rapist, in which case they should deny. We who are followers of Jesus in America, we have to struggle with this, actually. That's the truth. It's a struggle. If you've ever said something like, you know, who are you to tell me how to live? Or I have a right to pursue my own happiness. Or I have to be myself. Then you're like repeating the philosophy. You're just repeating this thing that is constantly repeated to us all the time. Personally, I have to constantly fight against that way of thinking in my own thoughts. But I do fight. Because if you're serious about following Jesus, you have to fight the whole philosophy of expressive individualism. Why? Because what Jesus says could not be more opposite. Completely different about the path to happiness and human flourishing. It's so different. What Jesus says is so incredibly different and so radical to our ears that when we hear it, we have a hard time taking it seriously. It's like he couldn't mean what he's saying because it's so different. Let's look. Mark 8:34. Then Jesus called the crowd to himself along with his disciples, and he said to them, those who want to follow me must say no to the things they want. Pick up their crosses and follow me. Those who want to save their lives will lose them. But those who lose their lives for me and for the good news will save them. One good does it do for people to win the whole world yet lose their lives? Or what should a given person give in exchange for life? If people are ashamed of me and what I say in this unfaithful and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of those people when he comes with the holy angels in his Father's glory. It's almost shocking, if you really look at it, to modern 21st century American ears. Almost every word negates expressive individualism. Let's break it down. Number one, the main points Jesus is making. He says, if you want to follow Jesus, you have to say no to the things you think you want. Jesus here is not talking about saying no to that extra piece of cake. Or any of the other little things that we have to say no to in life. That is not what he's talking about. In fact, they probably couldn't imagine a society where there's so much food that you have to think about saying no to food. He's talking about those wants that are deeper in our souls, but that come out of our brokenness and our selfish ambitions and our greed and our lust. That come out of that place where we are not 100% good and we are not all right. These things we must say no to. And he says this is a must. It's a must. If you're following Jesus, you can't follow that other stuff and follow Jesus, because you can't have two masters. If you're following Jesus, understand the question of life becomes no longer what do I want or even what will make me happy. That's not the question. The question becomes only and always, every single day, what does Jesus want? What does Jesus want? That's all that matters. What does Jesus want? The Apostle Paul says much the same thing in his instructions to his mentor, Titus. Titus 2:11. He says, for the grace of God has appeared that offers salvation to all people, and it teaches us to say no to ungodliness and worldly passions, and to live self-controlled, upright, and godly lives in this present age. We who follow Jesus should not be just like everybody else. We who follow Jesus give up our right to be ourselves and pursue our own desires. We're to be a people who live our lives differently. We who follow Jesus understand our lives are not our own. Once you kind of say yes to Jesus, your life belongs to him. You're his property. We belong to him. And we have a greater and a deeper desire than all those other desires. Something even further down, more deeper, more important, that desire to please him. That makes us different. And you know what? It doesn't matter whether your neighbor or your coworker understands exactly why you're so different, so much as that they see that you are different than everyone else. You know, when I first moved to Chicago, I worked for the IRS for a few years. It was fun on my side of the desk. I actually enjoyed it. I did. I really enjoyed it. But the thing was, it seemed like everybody, all my coworkers, all they ever talked about in break time was about how to make more money and how to get higher on the ladder and how to get the next promotion. That's all they ever talked about. And they talked about the latest stock market scheme to somehow make yet a little more money. And I started to think something was wrong with me, that I didn't think the same way. That I wasn't, like, doing that. Like, I wasn't thinking about any of that stuff. I was sort of like, maybe I'm missing out on here. Maybe I don't have enough money. Although I had plenty. But I started thinking I didn't. And then I realized what the difference was. They weren't saying no to their selfish desires. They were like pursuing it full on. It's all about me, me, me. And once I realized that, it got easier to be different. So you got to say no. That's the beginning. Number two, if you want to follow Jesus, you have to die to your own selfish desires, your own expression, your own ambitions, even maybe your own sense of self. When Jesus said, pick up your crosses, there was no question to his Jewish listeners what that meant. You know, we've forgotten that a cross was an instrument for cruel and torturous death. We think bearing my cross means putting up with that annoying person in my life. As if, you know, you're especially holy for putting up with somebody who's annoying. And, of course, the world is happy to supply plenty of them. But at the time that Jesus actually said these words, no one who ever picked up a cross lived for very long. It was a one-way ticket. To pick up a cross meant to embrace suffering and humiliation followed by death. So when he says this, it's really shocking. He's saying you have to die. But it's clear. If you want to follow Jesus, we have to die, most especially to our own desires, our own expression, our own ambitions. We have to suffer, maybe, along the way and choose to go that way. It becomes a whole new life with a different orientation. I suspect the believers in Iran right now understand this. To follow Jesus is to embrace suffering and maybe death, because for them it may be literally true. When the Apostle Paul talked about this, he put it this way, Galatians 2:20, he says, I no longer live. I no longer live, but Christ lives in me. The life I now live, I live by believing in God's Son who loved me and took the punishment for my sins. And it gets repeated again and again that we no longer live. We die. And then there's a new life that's living through us. And it gets repeated again and again, and then specifically applied to even our sexual desires. Colossians 3:5. Therefore, put to death whatever is worldly in you. Your sexual sin, perversion, passion, lust, and greed, which is the same as worshiping wealth. So when it comes to sexual desires, pretty much all of us are called to put some aspect of that desire to death, married or not married. There's a call to death for all of us. Because our personal desires are broken. They go in the wrong directions. They go too far. They have all kinds of difficulties. Everything that is in us about getting and about self-pleasure and self-satisfaction, whether it's of sex or possessions or ambition, all of it has to die. Now, I think a lot of people kind of want to have it both ways. They want to keep pursuing their own desires, but they try to add some good works to make up for it. So they say to themselves, I gave money to the panhandler, so now I can do whatever I want. But that's not how it works. That's not what Jesus is talking about. Dietrich Bonhoeffer, who was murdered by the Nazis, said it this way. He says, when Christ calls a man, He bids him to come and die. Folks, this is not just for some extreme situation for those who are heroes. Rather, Jesus said it's to be a daily reality for all who follow him. This requires what? Self-denial and self-control. The complete opposite of self-expression and self-pursuit. Self-denial and self-control. And sometimes, some days it's going to be hard, and sometimes it's going to be painful. But that's his call. Now, the powers of this age consider such a thing to be oppressive, abusive, horrific even, to even talk like this. To put to death your desires and to let someone else dictate the course of your life, it's not done. It's not good. It's unhealthy. And yet, it is still true that this is what Christ calls all of his followers to. And over many centuries, many, many millions of ordinary men and women have done the extraordinary by simply putting to death their own pursuit of happiness or fulfillment and instead pursuing Jesus and his approval only. That's how it is that 3 centuries ago, well, no, 5 centuries or so, 5 centuries ago, 2 young Moravians arranged to go to the slaves in the Caribbean to the point of selling themselves into slavery if necessary. And as they were on the ship sailing away to the Caribbean, knowing that they would die there, trying to share Jesus with the other people who were enslaved, they sang this song, saying, "May the Lamb that was slain receive the rewards of his suffering." That was all that mattered to them. And on that kind of heart and that kind of motivation, the Moravians went to all the lost and forgotten people of the world, the first to preach to the indigenous peoples of North America, the first to preach to the slaves in the Caribbean, the first to try to go to the Muslims. Because it was not about them. These were men who died to themselves, and in doing so, found something more wonderful and more powerful that led to everlasting joy. Because, see, the end of it is joy. And I long for every one of you, I long for every one of you to find that kind of joy. But you can't get there without taking up the cross. Number 3, Jesus says, those who pursue their own self-fulfillment and expression will end up empty, dead, unhappy. Those who seek to find their life themselves will in fact lose it. When we give ourselves over to our desires and our pleasures and our lusts, you know what happens? We end up empty, dead, and unhappy. It's no wonder that our society is so unhappy. There are all kinds of psychological studies that show this. Here's the problem. 1, when you live for yourself, you end up depersonalizing everybody else around you because you've made yourself the God. And then you break connections with people and also with God, so now you're lonely and disconnected. That's not how we're designed. We end up like a car engine with not enough oil. It'll go for a bit, and then it's going to melt down. It's not going to flourish. I saw a recent study showing that right now there's a crisis in male friendships. Men don't have any friends anymore. And as a result, guess what? They have higher risk for heart disease, cancer, and stroke. They're literally being killed by loneliness, because the pursuit of self-expression is leaving them with no friends. We've now had over 50 years of this indoctrination and expressive individualism. What's come of it? More loneliness, more violence, more suicide, more drug addiction, more broken families. Folks, it's not working. As a society, we've given ourselves over to the unconstrained pursuit of individual happiness and expression with the strong avoidance of suffering. Like anything that involves suffering, well, that's evil, and we want to stay away from that. But that's not actually true. And it often doesn't work. Now, sure, here at our church, we pray for healing every week. Not everybody gets healed, but we pray for people every healing. But there's all kinds of other suffering. Rejection and shame and discrimination. Here's the irony. In order to live, in order to become all that we are truly made by God to be, in order to be truly happy, we all must go through some kind of suffering and discipline. Okay? It's like the saying they make in the gyms, no pain, no gain. That's why I don't really like them. The thing is, we need that. We need the constraint. We need the discipline. We need the suffering, actually, to become who we meant to be. And only in becoming who we're truly meant to be do we find genuine happiness. But in the name of freedom, we often reject the suffering and the discipline that we most need. There's a writer named, I'm probably going to mispronounce his name. It's French, but just I think it's Jacques Philippe. We'll try that. Anyway, he pointed out the most painful suffering is the suffering we reject. And the irony is that our hedonistic society's notion that all suffering is an evil to be avoided at any price leads people to make themselves unhappy. You see, we think that having no constraints and no suffering is what's going to make us happy. So it's really sort of the toddler approach to life. Have you been around a toddler lately? Think 2-year-old? Like, the world is for them and about them and centered around them. And if mommy doesn't give them what they want when they want it, then mommy is a bad mommy. And suffering, of course, should never happen, not even for 2 seconds. But no loving parent ever lets their child grow up with no constraints and no denial of their desires. We don't want to leave them as toddlers. And of course, the toddler thinks that their discipline is extreme torture. And we'll be happy to let you know all about it. But those who love them, make them go through the discipline anyway. Number 4. Oh, we're doing good on time. Number 4. Those who submit and sacrifice their lives to God are the ones who will end up alive and fulfilled and happy in the long term. Here's a first step, a simple beginning. A happy person is the one who has found that there's more joy in making someone else happy than in being happy. When we die to ourselves, we become free to love God and others truly. And in their happiness, we find unspeakable joy. Those who no longer live for themselves find tremendous contentment because they become impervious to fear and anxiety because they're not living for themselves anymore. I have 8 grandchildren. Let me tell you, they make me happy. They really make me happy. So happy. For them, I'm willing to do things I might not otherwise do. For them, I will get down on the floor and do things I haven't done in a long time. For them, I will play games and let them win. Because in making them happy, I become happy. I don't care what I get at Christmas. as long as they are completely excited and happy about what they get at Christmas. And that's just in this life. Jesus reminded us there's another life coming. And your love for Jesus will determine how happy that life is going to be. But in order to love Jesus, we have to give up many things. And most importantly, our freedom to pursue our worldly desires, our selfish desires, and avoid suffering. Crosses inevitably involve suffering. But here's the thing. When we suffer through the pangs of saying no to our desires and dying to ourselves, that suffering does something wonderful. It actually draws us closer to Jesus. And out of that closeness comes joy beyond description. That closeness to Jesus is so good, it's as if you gave up nothing. Philippians 3, verse 7, the Apostle Paul, who gave up everything his life was about, wrote, "But whatever were gains to me, I now consider loss for the sake of Christ. What is more, I consider everything a loss." Really, the word he uses there is like garbage, only a little more crass than that. You know, sort of, well, anyway, I'll let you fill in the blank. But, you know, the most worthless stuff you can imagine, okay? Whatever is more, I consider everything a loss because of the surpassing worth of knowing Christ Jesus my Lord, for whose sake I have lost all things. I consider them garbage that I may gain Christ and be found in him, not having a righteousness of my own that comes from the law, but that which is through faith in Christ, the righteousness that comes from God on the basis of faith. I want to know Christ, yes, to know the power of his resurrection and participation in his sufferings, becoming like him in his death, and so somehow attaining to the resurrection from the dead. There's a closeness and intimacy to be had with Jesus that is yet unexplored. Untouched, unseen, there is so much more that it makes dying to ourselves and saying no to ourselves and giving up and losing what the world thinks is crazy to lose makes it all seem as nothing. Over the years of following Jesus, I have gained a new set of desires. Now, sometimes the old ones still hang around. I'll be honest about you, there's still a battle that happens. But there's a new set of desires. I desire to see Jesus and to see him at work. What makes me most happy is when I see people captured by the love and power of God. You know, when Ted and I were talking about this, he says, "I've seen you. Like, you laugh like you never laugh when you see people being touched by God." You know, I call it the most addictive thing in the universe because it is such a powerful sense of joy. It's really amazing. I can never get enough of it. It's what holds me in this ministry. Yeah? Have I had to give up things? Of course. Have I suffered? Oh, sure. Suffered from being a broken person in a broken world, suffered from all the ins and outs of church life, suffered from, you know, all kinds of things. Yes, I've suffered, but none of it compares to the goodness of this new desire and this new way of living. And this way of sacrifice and suffering is often the only pathway towards genuine change and growth. It's like the necessity for a seed to die in order to produce a harvest. There's a death that must happen for life to emerge. In her book, The Broken Way, author Anne Voskamp wrote, "There is no growth without change. No change without surrender. No surrender without wounds. No abundance without breaking. Wounds are what break open the soul to plant the seeds of a deeper growth. For a seed to come into its own, it must become wholly undone. The shell must break open, its insides must come out, and everything must change. You might mistake it for complete destruction. But brokenness can make abundance, and the weight of hell shifts imperceptibly to make the weight of glory." Now, I could chew on that one for a month. One more point, number five. You have to decide which community you want to fit in with. The last thing Jesus said was, "If people are ashamed of me and what I say in this unfaithful and sinful generation, the Son of Man will be ashamed of those people when he comes with the holy angels and his Father's glory." This is about community. The truth is that our philosophy of life is mostly shaped by our community. We have a community that's around us. Here in Chicago and Evanston, we have a community with our neighbors and our families. And these communities are completely given over to expressive individualism. They aren't necessarily listening to Jesus. And when you don't fit into their community, to that community, on their expressive individualism, they're horrified. And you feel shamed. Shame becomes an instrument of pressure to shape our thinking and our choices because you want to fit in. It's a natural human desire to want to fit in with our community. For those of you who are younger in particular, the power of community in shaping your thinking is stronger usually than any kind of rationality or logic. You think the way you think because everybody you know thinks that way. But the community we are in is a secular community and hostile to everything about Jesus. Someone said to me recently, "It's hard to be a Christian in Evanston." Perhaps, I thought. And I almost said out loud, but I was trying to be nice. Not as hard as it is to be a Christian in Turkey or Iran. But I do agree that it's harder than it's been before. If you're honest, it's hard to break with our community to think a different way or live a different way. You might find you have internal resistance to everything I'm saying right now because to accept what I'm saying will cost you something. You know, Upton Sinclair once said, "It's difficult to get a man to understand something when his salary depends on his not understanding it." Like, you don't want to, like, understand it, because, like, if you do, then, like, you might have to change. But Jesus is helping us here by pointing out there's another community. More important and longer lasting. What you see here with your physical eyes isn't the only community. There's a community of angels and all the saints who have gone before us. They are not far away. They are near. They're just on the other side. The Bible describes them as the great cloud of witnesses. They're watching. They're watching us. Many of them were martyred when they refused to go along with their community and their time. In their time, they had to die to themselves in order to find the joy of life in Jesus. And we will be with them one day. So when you're concerned about not fitting in, you need to remember that community. You need to remember that. Like, well, what about them? What about that community? How am I going to fit in with them? So you have to decide which community you want to fit in with. Which is more important to you? Is it fitting in with your coworkers and neighbors, or fitting in with Jesus and the angels and the saints in glory? That's the challenge Jesus is making. I don't have to add to it. He's making it himself. But at some point, you have to be clear which community is more important to you. It doesn't mean, of course, we have to be nasty or hateful to the people that we live around. Quite not at all. We're called to love even our enemies, even those who mistreat us. The martyrs blessed those who killed them, even while they refused to engage in the idolatry that they were being killed for. They refused to change, but they blessed the people who gave them all kinds of suffering for it. But it does say something of whose approval we are looking for. I'm not looking for approval from any of our politicians or authorities or entertainers. I'm not looking for approval from my barber or my neighbors. I want to be nice to them, but I'm not looking for approval from them. I'm not looking for approval from even my family members. I love them, but I'm not even really looking for approval from them. I'm looking for approval from just one person. Jesus. Jesus. Just one person. That's it. I'm determined to live his way as best I can, and I'm determined to speak about his words and his way openly and courageously because I'm looking for his approval. I'm going to be kind to everybody else and kind to all those other groups and people who disagree with me, but I am not going to be quiet, and I'm not going to be ashamed of Jesus. And that's important for the path to happiness. Because you see, if you're caught in the middle, I want to fit in with this community, but I want to fit in with Jesus. If you're caught in the middle, if you're not clear about your ultimate loyalties, you're going to be miserable. You're going to feel tense and unhappy and ashamed of what Jesus said, and that's going to make it hard to be a Christian. That's what causes you to say it's hard to be a Christian in Evanston. Once you've died to yourself, it's not that hard. Because then you find true happiness and joy that lasts forever. It's not hard at all once you've determined to let Jesus shape your desires and give you desires that will lead to true and lasting happiness. So you have to make a choice. Be true to yourself. Express yourself, live for yourself, or take up your cross, die to yourself, and follow Jesus. It's one or the other. In the words of the old song, I have decided to follow Jesus. No turning back. Though none go with me, still I will follow. No turning back. No turning back. What's your choice?